Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and tonight we're doing a deep dive into Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. All right, my friends, welcome back to Hitchens on Horror and our deep dive exploration into the Friday the 13th franchise, the first 8 movies released in the 1980s, which, for me, I think, is the best slasher franchise ever made. So, I apologize for the delay for this episode. I've decided to make this a bi-weekly podcast, for the reason that my editor is nagging me. For those who may not know me, I am also an author. I've written 2 books, Haunted History of Delaware, which is where I was born and raised, and Haunted History of Philadelphia, which is where I have lived for the past 20 years of my life. And you can check out those books if you like. They're a mixture of history, ghost stories, and folklore, but I am currently working on my 3rd book, which is called Eerie Delaware, which features Delaware ghost stories, folklore, and also true crime and alien encounters and legends. It's a real mixed bag. It's going to be great. But my editor has emailed me and was like, "Hey, how's the book coming along?" And I realized that a lot of the time I've been doing this podcast, I could also be working on the book that is due. So we're going to do bi-weekly because I love doing this podcast. I'm so appreciative of all of you who are listening to these episodes week by week, episode by episode, throughout the Friday the 13th series that we're doing now. And I do plan to continue the Hitchens on Horror podcast with a series once we're done with the 8th Friday the 13th movie, but I'll wait to make that announcement. But again, thank you all for supporting me and waiting patiently for this episode. And this is worth the wait because Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives is unquestionably one of the most beloved movies in the franchise for good reason. It is, I think, by far, with all due respect to the writers and directors who have worked on the previous films, the best written and the best directed movie of the Friday the 13th franchise. The thing that I love about the whole Friday the 13th series and why I think, for me, it is the greatest, better than Halloween franchise, better than the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, its 2 big competitors during this time, is that all the Friday the 13th movies are in sort of response and conversation with one another. That from movie to movie, because they had this amazing classic basic formula from day one, from the first film, the movies that were made subsequently are really about, okay, we have this winning formula, this killer, if you'll pardon the pun, formula. How do we expand on that? How do we riff on that? How do we give something that these audiences who are coming to these movies year after year in droves, something different to see? And Friday the 13th, I think, does that better than any of the others. You know, there are the extreme examples of, you know, the 3rd movie, which we're going to make this 3D, or the 2nd movie where we're going to make Jason the killer, or the 4th movie, the final chapter, we're going to make this the final chapter, we're going to kill Jason. But then, oh, we're still making a lot of money, so we're going to make another one, but we're going to call it A New Beginning, and we're going to do something really different and have a situation where it's not actually Jason. And we're going to make a movie that is full of nudity and violence and, you know, bad language and just make it crazy. And this movie that we're going to be watching together tonight is very much a response to the last one. And I said in the previous episode that I really do like Part 5, A New Beginning. Because I think it is so different, it's almost 70s sleazy kind of horror movie thing going on, and I'm here for that. But this is a very different direction that we're going in, that Frank Mancuso Jr. and the other producers decided to go in with Part 6. Because there was, of course, even though Part 5 made a decent amount of money, it made $10 million less than the final chapter. So that's something that they obviously had to consider. So in making Part 6, they decided that there was one thing that they wanted to do. They wanted to bring Jason Voorhees back to life, however the director and writer chose to do that. And the person that the producers, Frank Mancuso Jr. among them, decided to choose to embark on this task of making the sixth Friday the 13th movie in 1986 was Tom McLaughlin, who has a really kind of fascinating life and history and how he entered into the filmmaking world. So Tom McLaughlin moved to Paris when he was 19 years old and studied fencing, acrobatics, dance, and he said he watched movies constantly in Paris. There was a movie theater across the street from where he lived, and he saw basically every genre of film and drank it all up as he watched it. And when he returned to America after he finished his education, he wanted to make movies, but he wanted to make silent movies, movies like Jacques Tati was making at the time. And he's an actor too, Tom McLaughlin is. He started performing one-man shows in mime. And in mime, for anyone who may not know, if it's a mime, everything is silent. Everything is shown through physical action and physical expression. And what Tom McLaughlin was doing in Los Angeles with mime at this period in time was really interesting in that he wasn't doing like the classical mimes of like, oh, I'm in a box, like the stereotypical thing that you've seen on a million sitcoms or whatever. He was doing mime that was relevant to the current world, that was about war and that was about drugs and sex and the younger generation. He formed the LA Mime Company, and Dick Van Dyke, the legendary Dick Van Dyke, eventually came to see Tom McLaughlin performing with the LA Mime Company and was really impressed by him. And Dick Van Dyke, sitcom star and legend, hired Tom McLaughlin as a writer for Dick Van Dyke's relatively short-lived show, Dick Van Dyke and Company. And what Tom McLaughlin was tasked to do for this show, he was given the opportunity to write but also direct the guest appearances that happened during the Van Dyke and Company show. So Tom McLaughlin, this 20-something nobody really, was suddenly writing and directing scenes for actors like Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett, like these legendary performers. And he got an Emmy nomination for that, for writing for Van Dyke and Company, that show. So that's part of why he got on the radar of the producers of Friday the 13th. But there's two other reasons why. So Tom McLaughlin's first film that he directed in 1982 was a horror movie called One Dark Night, which is set in a mausoleum. And Tom McLaughlin was very inspired by the stories and poems of Edgar Allan Poe. And One Dark Night was also very inspired by Tom McLaughlin when he visited as a teenager the Catacombs of Paris, where, for anyone who may not know, the Catacombs of Paris, there are endless caverns of bones and remains that are stacked in beautiful artistic ways, because at the time in Paris they couldn't afford to bury all the bodies in cemeteries, so they put them in these catacombs and put them in these beautiful designs. And Tom McLaughlin said that visiting the catacombs of Paris, that was the first time that he experienced real, true terror, where he knew that everything was okay, but he just felt this sense, this presence of terror, that something was watching him, something was after him. And that is what, along with Poe, really brought him into his movie One Dark Night, which I really want to see. I haven't watched it yet. I want to. That movie stars Meg Tilly, who is also known in horror circles for Psycho 2. I'm excited to watch it. But, so there's that. That excited the producers of Friday the 13th. But the other thing that excited producers of Friday the 13th is that Tom McLaughlin, along with having made this horror movie, which, by the way, was rated PG, despite all its, like, zombies and corpses, was rated PG. He had also been shopping around Hollywood a lot of scripts that were comedies. And it was this combination of making horror and also wanting to do comedy that intrigued Frank Mancuso Jr. and the producers of Friday the 13th to hire him as the writer-director of Part 6, which later became known as Jason Lives. And Tom McLaughlin has said, and this is a direct quote, "It was one of the great times of my life, where they gave me a private screening room at Paramount Pictures and let me watch all the movies back to back." Tom McLaughlin said that he thought that the series went, and this is again a quote, a little sideways with Part 5. So he wanted to start with his movie, which was going to be the sixth movie, basically kind of ignoring, in a way, Part 5. But starting with the same idea, that starting with the character of Tommy Jarvis, which was originated by Corey Feldman in The Final Chapter, the fourth movie, has been locked up in a mental institution due to his trauma, gets out, and accidentally revives Jason in a cemetery. So, as you remember, The Final Chapter begins with a scene that was filmed with Corey Feldman in a cemetery where Jason comes back, but it's supposed to be a dream. But in Tom McLaughlin's vision, they basically redo that scene, but redo it as if it is real. Tom McLaughlin wrote the script for Friday the 13th, Part 6, during Christmas time, and he said that he was having a lot of fun giggling and laughing as, you know, his family was gathering around the Christmas tree and opening presents, and he was writing different crazy ways to kill people. Tom McLaughlin was also raised Catholic, and he has said that is a very important influence in this film, that even though he was raised Catholic, wasn't necessarily a follower of the faith in his adulthood, but that those values were instilled into him. And you can see that in several aspects of this movie, particularly in the fact that when he finished his script for Friday the 13th, Part 6, he called it Jason Has Risen, which the producers said, no, you can't call it that. People are going to get pissed off. And they're probably right, because America. So it was evolved into Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. Now, also, when these actors signed on to Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning, John Shepard, who played Tommy Jarvis, replacing Corey Feldman as Tommy Jarvis in A New Beginning, Melanie Kinneman, the final girl of A New Beginning, and Shavar Ross in his amazing performance of Reggie the Reckless in A New Beginning, one of my favorite performances in the franchise, as I said last episode. To sign on for A New Beginning, they also signed contracts that said that they had to appear in the sixth movie, if that did transpire. But eventually, none of them would appear in this movie. The first casualty was Shavar Ross, who, again, was a young adult during the time of the making of this movie. And the idea was that in the sixth movie, Shavar Ross's character, Reggie the Reckless, would be killed off by Jason. And understandably so, Shavar Ross's parents were like, "You are not killing my child on screen. That's not going to happen." So, exit Shavar Ross. Love you. Love your performance. John Shepard, who excellently played Tommy Jarvis in A New Beginning, was very tempted to do this film. I talked about in the last episode how dedicated he was, almost very method acting, you know, interning at a psychiatric institution to get into his character, auditioning in character, took it really seriously, even though it was a slasher movie, and he was an evangelical Christian, and even though when he was cast in the film, he was led to believe it was a movie called Repetition, not a Friday the 13th movie. John Shepard was really actually interested in doing Jason Lives, because there is a scene, there's a scene where there's Jason and a little girl, a child, and she prays, and Jason decides to spare her. And John Shepard, with the faith that he had, was like, maybe this is a sign from God that I'm meant to do this. Like, this, again, is conforms with my teaching and what I believe, that good conquers evil, that God conquers evil, and faith conquers evil. But he was kind of on the fence about continuing with acting or entering seminary to become a minister. And eventually, John Shepard decided that the correct path in his life was to leave acting and enter seminary school and become a minister, which is what he did. He did become a minister. But with that, Melanie Kinneman's contract expired. She has gone on record in various documentaries and in the book Crystal Lake Memories that the producers were like, "We want you and John Shepard together," and when John Shepard said no, they were no longer interested in her, which is a shame. But that is how the casting went. So it's interesting in that, in this series, the only character that appears in multiple movies, beside Jason Voorhees, who appears obviously in all the films, Mrs. Voorhees, who appears in two of the films, played by Betsy Palmer. But the only other character, there's Alice that appears in the first and the second. But other than those, Tommy Jarvis is the character that appears most frequently. He is in three movies back to back. In The Final Chapter, the fourth movie, played by Corey Feldman. In A New Beginning, played by John Shepard. And also in Jason Lives, played by Tom Matthews, who we'll be talking about. So Tommy Jarvis, is a really important character in the Friday the 13th mythos. And it's interesting to see his story finally played out to its conclusion in this film. Tom McLaughlin, when he was talking with Frank Mancuso Jr. and the producers, asked them from the get-go, because they knew his resume. They had seen the movie he'd done, the horror movie, and the scripts, the comedy scripts they had written. They had, so they knew who he was as an artist and what his interests were and what his strengths were. And Tom McLaughlin asked the producers, "Can I make it funny?" And the producer said, "Yes, as long as you don't make fun of Jason." And that gave birth to, I think, what is the best written and best directed film in this franchise. And I am not alone in that opinion. Tom McLaughlin's script and direction was really influenced by a love of the universal horror movies from the 1930s and 1940s, especially Frankenstein. And he also very subversively include self-referential comedy and Easter eggs for fans of the previous films. Like, this is the first Friday the 13th movie that knows it is a Friday the 13th movie, and where the characters know that they are in a Friday the 13th movie. And this level of kind of conscious knowledge of the genre had not existed in a horror movie before. And that is one of the things that makes this film so extraordinary. This is also the shortest of the Friday the 13th films. It's only 86 minutes long, but it's great. It is also the only film in this entire franchise that features no nudity at all. Which, again, I think is a reaction to Part 5, A New Beginning, which had the most nudity of all. But in Jason Lives, nothing. This, more importantly, is the first movie since the first Friday the 13th in 1980 that, again, takes place in Camp Crystal Lake, at that actual camp. We've been away from it and adjacent to it for the movies we've been watching since then. And this movie also is the first movie that actually takes place on Friday the 13th. Because again, you know, if you remember the second, third, fourth movies, they're all basically one film occurring over several days. But this movie, we're back to Camp Crystal Lake, albeit in a different form, which I'll talk about later. And we're back to Friday the 13th, Jason's birthday, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The other great thing about Jason Lives, the sixth movie in this franchise, is that, again, we've had several movies that were filmed in California, and you can really see that. That makes a difference in their look and in their feel, especially because the first two movies were filmed in New Jersey and Connecticut. They have that real authentic look to them. It feels almost like a documentary. But for the first time since the first two movies, we are filming at a real Boy Scout camp called Camp Daniel Morgan. And that is located in Covington, Georgia, which gives a different flavor to the franchise and I think brings it back to that real world that the first two films had. Okay, let's talk about Jason in this movie. So, first of all, the original actor cast as Jason was a stuntman, an actor named Dan Bradley. But he was fired by the producers very early on. Once they started filming, they saw the footage and they were like, "No, you have to get this guy out." And this was not Tom McLaughlin's decision as writer-director. He's made that very clear. This was a producer decision that he had to go along with. And the reason why Dan Bradley was fired has been reported in many different ways. Most of the ways that it has been reported is that he, on camera, on film, was more heavy set than they wanted Jason to be. Going to be crude, but according to one of the crew members, they called him Bitch Tits Jason, which is not cool. Fat phobia is not cool. But he was let go. Dan Bradley does survive in the film, though. And there's a scene involving paintball that you're going to see. And that is Dan Bradley's only scene that is left in the film. So they rehired Jason. They hired a person named C.J. Graham, who appeared in all of the scenes in the film aside from that paintball scene. And C.J. Graham is, I think, one of the best Jasons for me. He was a Marine. He's an Army guy. And the way that he was found by the makers of Friday the 13th is that there was a show... in Vegas, I think, where there was a hypnotism thing. And at the end of this hypnotism thing, an actor playing Jason Voorhees came out and terrorized the audience. And C.J. Graham is the person who played that. And that's how he got the role. And he's great. He's great, Jason, I think. The only other... This is... one of only two acting roles that C.J. Graham played. He played a major acting role in 1992's Highway to Hell. That and Jason Lives, that's his only credits. But I think he's a great, great Jason. So we had to find a new Tommy Jarvis, of course. And Tom McLaughlin, in the casting, wanted an actor that looked like Corey Feldman all grown up. And he found Tom Matthews. Tom Matthews, for horror fans, was in The Return of the Living Dead in 1985, and later was in also Return of the Living Dead Part 2 as a completely different character. And he's really committed himself to the franchise in the years that have come. He reprised his role of Tommy Jarvis in Friday the 13th, The Game, which was released in 2007, and in several of the fan-made sequel movies. I don't want to go into this too much because there's lots of litigation involved, but there's a reason why there haven't been any Friday the 13th movie since 2009, and the reason why is because there's been a big lawsuit between Sean S. Cunningham and Victor Miller, which has recently received a resolution, which I'll talk about at the end of our series of this films. But in the wake of that, there have been a lot of really well-done, fan-made Friday the 13th films that are available on the internet involving a lot of the original cast, and Tom Matthews has been involved in several of them. For the final girl for Jason Lives, Frank Mancuso Jr. put out a very clear directive. He wanted a very attractive blonde as the final girl. So, along that directive, Tom McLaughlin hired Jennifer Cook as Megan, the final girl in this film. Now, Jennifer Cook had been acting since her childhood. She'd been in a lot of things, but she came to Tom McLaughlin's attention for her performance in V, the series. And V is something that I think is largely forgotten by a lot of horror fans today, but it originated as a miniseries in the 1980s, and then had a sequel miniseries, and then had a TV series that was a sequel to that. It was a big deal, kind of the beginning of the whole lizard people alien thing that has become a meme in present years. Jennifer Cook had a lead role in V, the series, and Because she had been acting for so long, she wanted to do other things. She decided, this is going to be my final thing. This is what I'm going to do. And she's great in it. We also have, in this cast, Carrie Noonan as Paula. She has lots of amazing guest roles on television and also an extensive theater career in California. She eventually went back to school and earned a PhD in folklore and mythology. And she now teaches at several universities, specializing in Celtic folklore and Afro-Caribbean religions. And she also is a singer and guitarist for an Irish folk band called the MacGuffins, which I love. Also in this film, we have Renee Jones as Sissy, which we think might be a reference. The character name might be a reference to Sissy Spacek, the lead role in Carrie, who inspired the first jump scare of Boy Jason rising out of the water in Friday the 13th, Part 1. Renee Jones, again, has lots of television roles, but is most famous for playing the character of Lexi Carver on the soap opera Days of Our Lives from 1993 to 2012, for which she received 5 nominations for Outstanding Actress in a Daytime Drama from the NAACP Image Award. We also, in this cast, have Darcy DeMoss as Nikki. Darcy DeMoss has such, if you've been paying attention to these episodes, has a really interesting, troubled odyssey in the Friday the 13th franchise. So she appears in Friday the 13th, the final chapter, as one of the women in the aerobicized videos that is watched by one of the characters who is going to be slaughtered very soon. Darcy DeMoss was also cast in Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, in the role that was eventually played by Debbie Sue Voorhees. But Darcy DeMoss, during that process, was uncomfortable that she was being asked to do nudity, to take off her shirt and expose her breasts. But she was cast in the role. And she has said that when she was having her wardrobe fitting prior to her first day of shooting, the director of Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, Danny Steinman, actually propositioned her, asked her out to dinner. And she said no. And then she said the next day, I was off the movie. I didn't have a part. But she said she did get paid for it anyway. But finally, we have Darcy DeMoss in a Friday the 13th movie with a director that is not a misogynist piece of shit. As much as I love Danny Steinman's work in Part 5, I talked about the actors and crew recollections of him speak for themselves. We also, in this cast, have Nancy McLaughlin, who is the wife of writer-director Tom McLaughlin, as the character of Lisbeth. And she was she dies early in the movie, which we will discover, but she became really the den mother of the entire cast of this film. She stayed on the shoot for the entire filming after her character had died. She really took everyone under her wing and, along with Tom, made this a very happy, pleasant shoot. Like, if you've been paying attention, like, A New Beginning was really a movie that was made by everyone doing a lot of drugs, specifically cocaine. But in all accounts of the making of Jason Lives, the 6th Friday the 13th movie, there was no drug use. It was very wholesome. Everyone had a good time. After filming, the cast would get together. They'd play Scrabble together night after night. Occasionally, when they felt racy, they'd play Truth or Dare. But there was also they stayed in a really, really mangy hotel that was float in Georgia that was close to a Waffle House. And they did say that there was a lot of time spent at this Waffle House, drinking and eating. But mostly it was a very wholesome thing. Now, also in this film, you have Tony Goldwyn as the character of Darren. Tony Goldwyn is probably the most well-known actor that is in this film. Probably one of those well-known actors in the franchise to contemporary audiences. He's in the movie very prominent roles in the movie Ghost Nixon. He played Neil Armstrong in the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. He voiced the role of Tarzan in Disney's Tarzan. He played the president in the TV show Scandal, created by Shonda Rhimes. And he also directed a lot of episodes of Scandal and won a Peabody Award for doing so. Also in this movie, we've got, my God, Alice Cooper contributing music for the film, especially the final ending credits song, but also several others. Match Made in Heaven, I think. Like many Friday the 13th movies, Jason Lives was filmed under a title that was a David Bowie song. This movie was filmed under the title Aladdin Sane. Okay, let's get to the body count, shall we? So, here's the thing. Tom McLaughlin's original vision for Jason Lives was that there would only be 13 kills in this movie. Obviously, a cute reference to Friday the 13th. And when they screened the rough cut for this movie, the producers were like, "This is great. You've done a wonderful job. You need like 4 more kills." So they did some reshoots. And we'll talk about that. But the actual body count of Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, is 18 dead bodies. And here's some of the methods of murder that happen in this film. We have heart ripping. We have spears to the groin, spears to the mouth, arm ripping, triple decapitation with machete, broken bottle to the throat, double machete impalement, face crushing, knife to the head, body chopping, head ripping, dart to the forehead, and broken in half. Shout out to Martin Becker, who did the special effects makeup for this film, and his assistants Gabe Bartolos and Chris Briggs. And unfortunately, like all of the Friday the 13th movies, a lot of their work ended up on the cutting room floor, but you can still see enough of it to know they did a great job. Now, this movie, I would give 4 machetes. I think, and I said this at the beginning, I think there are 3 undisputably great movies in the Friday the 13th franchise. It's the first one, it's Friday the 13th, the final chapter, and it is Part 6, Jason Lives. Those are the great ones, in my opinion. But we're gonna have a lot of fun, because this movie has a lot of fun with itself. So I hope you enjoy. So, we are going to come back once you have watched 15 minutes and 30 seconds. So, grab your popcorn, grab your drink or whatever of choice, and let's start watching Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. We're going to have a lot of fun tonight, my friends. See ya in 15 minutes and 30 seconds. So we begin on a dark and stormy night, as all the best horror movies do. And what is essentially a redo of the opening of A New Beginning. Now, we have as Tommy Jarvis's sidekick an actor named Ron Palillo as Alan. Ron is best known for playing Arnold Horshack on the TV sitcom Welcome Back, Carter, which aired from 1975 to 1979, which I loved watching when I was growing up on Nick at Night. If you've never seen that show, I hope you check it out. It's also the birth of John Travolta as an actor. But Ron Palillo as Horshack also, aside from Welcome Back, Carter, was active in New York theater and television throughout his life and is a great presence in this movie, a really hilarious presence in this first scene. And the actors in this film pranked him constantly for his role of Horshack. And we see the opening shots of this film are really remarkable, I think, because you see Tommy Jarvis and his sidekick Alan walking through this creepy graveyard, which was all built on a soundstage, by the way, with a lantern. And it really looks and feels like an old Universal horror movie from the 1930s. Tom McLaughlin, the writer and director, has said that this movie would work great in black and white. And I agree with him. It really, truly captures that old school Universal horror movie feel, especially in this first scene. And we see Tommy dig up Jason, and it's revealed as this disgusting corpse crawling with maggots, with cobwebs all over him. It's a really evocative image. It is almost like a Lucio Fulci movie, almost like Zombie, the Fulci movie or something like that. And then Tommy goes crazy, stabs the corpse with an iron bar from one of the tombs, and then Alan says, "Oh, shit," and then lightning strikes twice that iron bar embedded in Jason's corpse, and he's alive. It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein born again. And this is really where the Friday the 13th series departs, because for the first five movies, Jason Voorhees, really 2 through 5. Jason Voorhees is human, and I've talked about a lot in the previous episodes why I think that is immensely valuable and one of the strengths of this series, that Jason Voorhees is a human being, that he is a boy who lost his mother and is avenging her with these camp counselors that caused her death. But this movie is where it changes, where Jason is no longer a human being. He is an undead supernatural force. There's a line in Tom McLaughlin's script that says, "Nothing stops this undead super killer." And that is where things change for the rest of this film. It's also, I have to say, the sound design in this film is so wonderful and specific. There's so many great touches in this movie. And along with that, we have Harry Manfredini, who I think delivers perhaps his best ever score in a Friday the 13th film, apart from the first movie. Because in the first movie, if you listen to the episode, Harry Manfredini had a very specific mission, that the music that accompanied the killer, that killer mommy killer, you'd only hear it when the killer was present. It's so good. But for part two, part three, part four, part five, Harry Manfredini is basically recycling that music in really great ways, truth be told. But in part six, I think Harry Manfredini was really inspired by the influences of the Universal horror movies that Tom McLaughlin had when he wrote and directed this film. The score in this movie does things that no other Friday the 13th movie does. It is so effective, so evocative. It's all new, mostly all new work. It's not until a long time in the film that you hear the famous ki 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 ma 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 that we've come used to. I also love the kill of Alan, the first kill in this film, where, again, this is now an undead Jason. An undead Jason just punches out Alan's heart through his chest. And there's actually a deleted shot where you see Alan's heart steaming on the ground and Jason and steps on it. Wish that had made the film, but the MPAA is always the enemy of these movies. It's true. And then we get to the opening credits, which are... like, oh my god, it's so good. First of all, it starts off with Jason Lives, not Friday the 13th. But then we get Jason walking as if he's James Bond. And then that slash of the machete and the blood that comes forth to let you know we're in a new era. Great, great, great opening credits. So once the movie proper starts to begin, of course, Tommy Jarvis goes to the police. They're not helpful. One of the police says, "Don't piss me off, Junior, or I will repaint this office with your brains." And there's also the thing of that Jason was going to be cremated, which has been stated in previous episodes, and that's never really explained. But the thing that's great about this movie is that, again, finally we're back to Camp Crystal Lake on Friday the 13th, but the community has decided to rename Camp Crystal Lake Forest Green, and that the camp is Camp Forest Green, which is a really, really interesting thing. But it's good to be home, finally. After all these movies that have been adjacent to Camp Crystal Lake, or afar from Camp Crystal Lake, we're finally back to where we started in 1980 with the first movie. So we are introduced to the characters of Darren and Elizabeth, and there's some great dialogue here. Elizabeth says, "Darren, we better turn around. I've seen enough horror movies to know some weirdo in a mask is never friendly." It's such great writing. And again, Elizabeth is played by Tom McLaughlin's wife, Nancy. And there's a great story here in that in the stabbing of the machete through the window shield, C.J. Graham, who again was a Marine, was conditioned to you strike the target. So when he was doing this stunt, he struck through the window of the car and almost very nearly missed Nancy McLaughlin, the director's wife. And during the subsequent scene, when Nancy's character, Elizabeth, is in the mud, they originally had a respirator for her. So, you know, the water would go through her, she could still breathe, but it didn't work. The mud in the puddle was coming down her throat. She was ingesting it. So eventually they decided, we're just going to wing it. And so she did the best she could in this ice-cold pool of mud. And the final moment of this scene is the card going through, is the card floating on that muddy water, that American Express card. And Tom McLaughlin has said that he left that shot lingering for a long time because he wanted people to call out in the theater the famous American Express slogan, "Don't leave home without it." And he said that in every single screening of this film that he attended, that is exactly what happened. And that's the beginning of Jason Lives. All right, my friends, watch until we get to 41 minutes and 25 seconds. Eat your popcorn. See you at 41 minutes, 25 seconds. So again, you have this wonderful meta-theatricality with the horror genre that Tom McLaughlin brings into this film. You have referenced Cunningham Road, which is, of course, a reference to Sean S. Cunningham, the original director and creator of the Friday the 13th franchise. There's reference to a town named Carpenter, which is, of course, named for John Carpenter, who wrote with Deborah Hill and created Halloween, the antecedent to the Friday the 13th franchise. You also have David Kagan as Sheriff Garris, who is named after Mick Garris, an horror writer and director that has been very active in the field over the years. It's great. So in this sequence, we also have to welcome Bob Larkin as Martin, the caretaker of the cemetery where the body of Jason Voorhees has been buried and subsequently unearthed, and then he decides to bury it again. And Tom McLaughlin went to Bob Larkin and said, "It's a small part, but it's one you're going to be remembered for." And Bob Larkin has said that Tom McLaughlin was exactly right and that he is so grateful for the opportunity that this film offered him. And he has the great line, "Who would want to dig up old Jason?" And then looking directly at the camera, at us. "Some people have a strange idea of entertainment." Which again is a level of meta in horror that had never existed in this genre before, I don't think. If there's something else, prove me wrong. But this film does things now, as we've talked about, and will continue to do, as we'll talk about, that I don't think had been done pre-1986. So, we have the character of Megan, played by Jennifer Cook, who does the second function that Tom McLaughlin, the writer-director, really wanted to do, in that he wanted to bring back the mythology of the character of Jason Voorhees because, again, if you've been listening to all these episodes and watching the movies along with me, as I hope you are, it hasn't really been addressed since part two. But Megan brings it back again in a short monologue to the campers where she talks about Jason and she says, "You know what? You know what today's date is, don't you? It's Friday the 13th. I can think of only one thing more terrifying." And then a school bus arrives with all the young children that all these counselors are responsible for caring for the next couple weeks. Again, a beautiful illustration of why this movie works, creating creating and going back to the mythology, making it creepy, and then pivoting to humor in a way that is actually real. Because, my God, if you're a young 20-something and all these kids are getting off the bus and you're responsible for taking care of them when your two lead counselors have already been murdered, that's some scary shit. I love it. Then we pivot to a scene where there are a lot of misogynistic dudes who are in the forest around Camp Crystal Lake, aka Camp Forest Green, doing paintball, and they're really mad that they are beaten by a woman who makes them then put on headbands that say dead, which is, again, a wonderful instance of Tom McLaughlin's sense of humor as a writer and director, because they all die very soon. One is killed by being thrown against a tree, and we see, like, this bloody smiley face carved into the wood of the tree where the face of the dead person impacted, which is great. And then there is a triple decapitation with Jason and his machete, which very, very sadly was truncated by the MPAA. This was a whole shot that the special effects team worked very, very hard on, where you would see in camera all the machete go through all of these three heads, and then all of these three heads drop to the ground, and the bodies drop to the ground. And it wasn't until the very first screening of this film that the writer-director Tom McLaughlin whispered to the lead effects expert before the scene happened, said, "By the way, all this scene is out." And he was like, "What?" And I get it. It's a shame. Fuck the MPAA. I mean, that's a big refrain for this franchise. We also have in this film Vincent Guestafaro as Deputy Rick Colon. What a great character name that is. Now, Vincent Guestafaro was, again, a theater actor, acted in many of the plays of David Mamet on Broadway and off-Broadway, and also was in a lot of TV and film, as so many of this cast was. Most notable, I think, for a role he played for several years on the show NYPD Blue, which I think is sadly forgotten now, but is one of the great TV shows of the 1990s. We have this great quote from Martin, the caretaker grave digger, who is swigging on his bottle of whiskey, who, when he's encountered by the cop, says, "Dig Jason up? Does he think I'm a fart head?" And then there's a smash cut to all the kids at the summer camp saying, "Yes!" Which, again, I think is a perfect example of what kind of movie this is and what kind of movie Tom McLaughlin is making. We have Tom Fridley as Court, who's this movie's resident hunky dumb guy character. So we have the female counselors, Megan and Sissy primarily, who are dealing with the girl campers at Camp Forest Green, which is really Camp Crystal Lake, but they don't know that. But then we have Tom Fridley as Court, who is dealing with the boys at Camp Crystal Green, or Camp Forest Green. And he does this whole hilarious and offensive, like, speech about the rocks and the Native Americans and what they meant about the rocks, that the boy children are, like, not hearing, they're not impressed at all. Yeah, so we established that dichotomy. And then we're back to Martin again at night, and Martin has been drinking that bottle of whiskey or whatever is almost gone. He's walking through the woods. He loses the road. And then there's something that rolls past him. And if you pay attention, you'll notice it's actually the severed head of one of the previous characters that has been killed in the paintball fight. And he's like, what's that? Doesn't really notice. Then he looks at the bottle and says, you're gonna be the death of me, but what a way to go. And then he drinks the rest of it and throws it down. And that turns out to be the truth, because then Jason is there, breaks the bottle, and jams it through his throat. And then, elsewhere in the woods of Camp Forest Green, we have two young lovers that are having a picnic together. We have Roger Rose as Stephen and Cynthia Kenya as Annette. And they're just having a good time, and they're like, first like, oh, we're not gonna have sex. That's a messy act. And then they decide, oh, we're gonna have sex. And then they're killed by Jason. Roger Rose, as Stephen, I have to mention, is a extremely prolific voice actor. Look at his Wikipedia. It's impressive what he does. So this section, where Martin the gravedigger slash caretaker of the cemetery, Roger Rose as Stephen, and Cynthia Kenya as Annette die, they die with a double impalement, a classic in this series at this point. All of that is a reshoot. None of this was in the original script or in the original movie. This was totally filmed, written and filmed and performed to satisfy the producer's decree of you need more kills in this movie. But I think the movie's better for it. It adds a nice respite from, because this movie establishes its characters really well. But then you have this interlude of these characters that you haven't spent a lot of time with, in some cases, including with Stephen and Annette, you've met for the first time, but they're all killed, Martin is killed, and they're dead, and then we're back to the programming as usual. The thing that I think makes this film really, really wonderful is that for the first time since the first scene of the first movie, there are actual children at Camp Crystal Lake. You know, I talked about, if you've listened to the first episode, that first scene where the killer, who we don't know who it is yet, walks through that bunk with these sleeping kids, and you wonder, oh my God, are these kids going to die? And it's such a wonderfully transgressive moment to begin this franchise. And for the first time since then, in the sixth movie, there are actual little kids at this camp who might be in danger of being killed. And I think that is one of the great things about this film that makes it successful. It's also why I think the movie Sleepaway Camp is successful as a slasher movie, which I talked about in the 62 horror movies series of this podcast. And there's so many fun things when we meet the children of this film. There's one little girl was laying in her bunk asleep like an angel, and folded across her chest is a copy of Jean Paul Sartre's No Exit. Actually, the same copy of No Exit and other plays that I had as a child. For anyone who may not know, who a lot of you may not know, Jean Paul Sartre's No Exit is a play about basically three people in a room who don't know why they're in the room, can't leave the room, and eventually they realize they're in hell, and has the famous line, hell is other people. So the fact that there is a little child reading this play is hysterical. Again, another instance of Tom McLaughlin's humor. And then we're back to, again, I think another echo of the first Friday the 13th. Because in the first Friday the 13th, if you remember, there's that, like, game of strip and Monopoly that brings the characters together. But in this movie, in Jason Lives Part 6, Sissy decides that they're going to play a game called Camp Blood, a card game based on all the killings that have happened, which is, I think, a really fun touch. But then one of the kids, who's named Nancy, has a nightmare. She has a nightmare that there's a monster. And there's a lot of conversation about the naming of this character, Nancy. Many people, of course, think that naming this child Nancy, who has a nightmare, is a tribute to A Nightmare on Elm Street, because in the first Nightmare on Elm Street and several of its sequels, the character of Nancy, played by Heather Langenkamp, is the protagonist of those films. But Tom McLaughlin, the writer and director, said he just named the kid Nancy because that was the name of his wife, who's also in this movie as Elizabeth, who's killed earlier, as we know. But he said, you can take whatever you want from it, which I appreciate. And I also think it's notable that it is 35 minutes into this film that we first hear that iconic music, the from Harry Manfredini. It's not till 35 minutes into this film that you hear that. That is not true of any other film in this franchise. Any other film in this franchise, that typical Friday 13th Jason music is used all over the place. But again, I think Harry Manfredini does his best score here. He saves that ki-ki-ki ma-ma-ma until it is best used. And we have, finally, the one and only sex scene in this movie. A rarity for Friday the 13th. And it's presented extremely funny in a wonderful way where Court and Nikki are having sex in the RV. And it's bouncing, bouncing, bouncing. And Jason sees it and sort of does a head tilt, like, what's going on here? And in this scene, again, Nikki is played by Darcy DeMoss, and when they were filming this particular scene, the producers realized that, oh, we're not on track to have any nudity in this movie, because, again, this is the only sex scene, they talked to Tom McLaughlin. Tom McLaughlin asked Darcy DeMoss, like, would you perhaps be willing to take your top off so we could see your breasts in this scene? And again, Darcy DeMoss, who had been through this in the previous movie, was like, sorry, sign the contracts, there's a no nudity clause, not doing it. And I honestly think that the scene is better for it. It's a really, really funny scene. They're doing this sex scene to the song Teenage Frankenstein by Alice Cooper. They finish, and then again, like I said, the great and detailed sound design of this film. When the sex is done, you hear the sound of Court taking a condom off of his dick. Again, and Tom McLaughlin said that was very intentional. He wanted to give a nod to safer sex in this movie. Because Tom McLaughlin really disliked the whole stigma that grown up around the Friday the 13th films is that sex equals death. And this was his rebellion against that. He's like, I'm going to give you a sex scene. I'm going to give you no nudity. I'm going to make the sex scene funny. And I'm going to give you a very clear sound of the male character ripping off a condom after it's done. Because they're being responsible people. Darcy DeMoss said that in the subsequent moments when the van is moving, like, and she's like being thrown on the bed with her legs up, Tom McLaughlin told her to make it like Lucille Ball in I Love Lucy, make it that kind of farce. And she's, of course, killed in the RV bathroom, head pushed through the wall, very memorable kill. And finally, the RV topples over and bursts into flames, which Tom McLaughlin said was the most difficult shot of this film, the one they are most nervous about because they could only do it once, but they did it perfectly, and the image that results from that, with Jason Voorhees getting up from that, you know, overturned on fire RV, standing on top of it, is really, really incredible. All right, my friends, watch now until 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 42 seconds. Refresh your popcorn. See you soon. So, David Kagan, who plays Sheriff Garris, was actually Jennifer Cook's acting coach for many years, and they were very excited to work together on this film. So, going back to the storyline, this movie just gets better and better as it goes on. Again, like it was in the previous film, A New Beginning, it's assumed that Tommy Jarvis is the one that is doing the killing at Camp Crystal Lake, a.k.a. Forest Green. We see Tommy Jarvis reading books like The Dead Or Alive and A Manual of the Occultism. And again, really fun in-jokes in horror history. Like, we see Karloff's General Store, named for the legendary Boris Karloff. And finally, in this sequence, Jason returns to Camp Crystal Lake, which is now known as Forest Green, and there's a really fun sign as he walks into it. The sign says that Camp Forest Green emphasizes friendliness, sportsmanship, integrity, courage, self-reliance, and tolerance. And of course, there are kids who are in danger. There's a really great scene where one of the cops says, "I'll order up some body bags." But in the original cut of this film, he said, "I'll order up some hefty bags to collect all the various body parts that have been collected from the paint massacre that we saw earlier." But they couldn't get the clearance to say hefty bags, so they said body bags, which is less funny, but is there. And we get the confirmation that it is Friday the 13th. So we have a scene with Sissy reading a magazine called Men at Play, obviously a version of Playgirl, and she gets her head twisted off. And then Megan picks up Tommy Jarvis, and we see Jason picking up Sissy's body past the cabin of the sleeping kids, and then Nancy, the child who had the nightmare earlier, wakes up. We then pivot to a scene where Megan and Tommy are driving, and we see a scene that's a sign that says "speeding?" question mark. Again, another really fun in-joke that Tom McLaughlin has put in. And we have another great song by Alice Cooper, Hard Rock Summer. And there's, again, great lines. "How do you want to proceed?" "With extreme caution, asshole." But back to the cabin with the children. The counselors have really good advice. They say, grown-ups think it's funny to be scared. And Paula says, "When I get scared, I'd close my eyes and say a little prayer. It worked for me, and I bet it'll work for you. And at that moment, we see Jason at the window outside, mirroring Paula as she's walking. Such a great shot. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful shot. And then there's again a interesting scene of the attraction of Megan and Tommy Jarvis, where Tommy Jarvis is in jail. Megan is, again, the daughter of the sheriff, and she's drawing him, and he steals the drawing, and then they end up awkwardly kissing through the bars, and then it turns really hot, and then she turns the tables on the deputy, Megan does, and with his gun that he's been very, very proud of earlier, with the laser red dots. Is it wherever the dot goes, the bullet goes? And Megan says the wonderful lines, again, I can't praise Tom McLaughlin enough, and the delivery of Jennifer Cook in this. She says, come on, hot lips, let's go. Let me know when we're about to blast into hyperspace. I'll fasten my seatbelt. And Tommy Jarvis's plan, he says, the only way to stop Jason now is to return him to his final resting place, where he drowned in 1957. And this is the other thing that Tom McLaughlin wanted to do. He wanted to bring the mythology back into the films. There's a great shot of Jason coming into the dorm of the kids with the wind and the leaves surrounding him. And Nancy, the kid we've been watching for quite some time now, wakes up. Jason, in his mask, leans into her. And she starts saying the prayer, the same prayer that I had written on my wall when I was a kid. Now I lay me down to sleep. Now I pray my Lord to soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, let my Lord my soul to take. And Jason leaves. And that, I think, is a really lovely thing that Tom McLaughlin did, is that he said that Jason would not kill the children because he himself had drowned as a child back in 1957. Still doesn't get rid of the danger, but it's a lovely, lovely moment. And then we have Sheriff Garris discovering the bodies of Sissy and Paula in their cabin. And the image that we see in their cabin, it's just completely soaked in blood. Every fabric, every piece of furniture in that room is soaked in blood. It's almost like the final victim of Jack the Ripper, Mary Kelly, if you look at those crime scene photographs, just completely soaked in blood. And then there's a child missing. Oh no. I'll meet you again at the end of this film, my friends. Refresh your popcorn for the final act of Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. So Nancy, the child who's missing, quickly finds a policeman and says, there's a scary man. And the policeman said, what scary man? And then there's Jason. And for the first time, we see Jason being shot at with multiple bullets through his body, and it doesn't do a damn thing. And then the policeman gets his head crushed. There's a great quote again from Tom McLaughlin's screenplay that nothing stops this undead super killer. And that is, again, what makes this movie different and a new chapter for the franchise. we see Tommy starting his master plan to chain Jason back to the bottom of Camp Crystal Lake. But in the midst of that, we again get a wonderful view of the children of this camp who are in the middle of this horrific slaughter. And there's two boys, and together the two boys say, "What do you think?" "I think we're dead meat." "Yeah. What were you going to be when you grow up?" Such great dialogue. Again, dialogue that identical to the movie Scream that would happen 10 years later in 1996, where, like, these children would never be smart enough to say these words, but in Tom McLaughlin's vision, they are saying these words. It's so wonderful. And then Jason breaks through the door at the kids. They run away screaming, and Tommy is on the lake, and he's screaming, "Jason, Jason, it's me that you want, remember? Come on, you maggot head. Come on, you pussy." Which, again, is also kind of funny. Jason walks towards Tommy under the water, comes under the water. Tommy starts a ring of fire with gasoline and flame around the boat he's in. And we see for a just brief second at the bottom of Camp Crystal Lake is the original Camp Crystal Lake sign. Lovely, lovely callback to the beginning. Then there's an underwater battle between Jason and Tommy Jarvis. And then Megan, who is determined to save Tommy, goes to the boat and turns on the boat's blade, which cuts Jason's throat and releases much blood into the water. And it should be known that this final scene, the scene where Jason gets the blade to the neck and all the blood and guts gets thrown into the water, that was filmed in Tom McLaughlin's father's swimming pool. And it ruined his father's swimming pool because of all the blood and guts and intestines. But his father said it was worth it. But Jason is finally at the bottom of the lake, and the kids, it's fun watching the kids in this movie, because there's one kid featured prominently who's wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt, one kid wearing a Masters of the Universe t-shirt, the He-Man cartoon that was very popular in the 80s that I watched religiously at the time. And they all say, "Yay!" When they know Jason's dead. And Tommy Jarvis, revived by Megan, finally says, "It's over. It's finally over. Jason's home." And the movie ends with a peaceful view of Camp Crystal Lake, a.k.a. Camp Forest Green. But then it goes below, and we see Jason below the lake, and his eye opens up, because he's undead now. You can't kill him anymore. You can only incapacitate him. This is such a great movie. I love it. I love it so much. It's so smart. I mean, and you have to, just to pay tribute to the ending credits with the song by Alice Cooper, "He's Back, the Man Behind the Mask." I mean, at the time of this movie's release, they made an MTV music video for this film with that song. Just to give you an idea of how culturally ubiquitous the Friday the 13th movies were at this time. So, so great. And also knowing that we're not done. Now, this movie, I think, is very special, as I've talked about, because with the self-referential nature of it, intentionally done by Tom McLaughlin, It predates Scream. Scream in 1996, of course, directed by Wes Craven, ushered in a whole era in the late 1990s of self-referential horror films. I mean, you could be argued that Wes Craven started that himself in 1994 with the movie New Nightmare, his installment in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. But the fact is that Jason Lives in 1986 predates all of that. It is at least 10 years ahead of its time. Kevin Williamson, who wrote the script for Scream, has gone many times on record that this film was his inspiration for the movie. And if you believe Tom McLaughlin, in 1995, Tom McLaughlin, the writer-director of Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, was offered to direct a script called Scary Movie by Kevin Williamson. And he passed on it because he said, I've already made that movie. And that script by Kevin Williamson, Scary Movie, eventually became Scream. I don't know why Tom McLaughlin did not go on to become more of a prominent director and writer in film. He's done many great things, and if you look at his biography, it bears it out. But based on what he did in Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, I don't think he got the career he deserved, because what he did in this film, I think, is extraordinarily great. It's so good, it's so smart, and so fun, and still horror. God bless you, Tom McLaughlin. All right, my friends. We have two movies in this sequence left to go. The next movie in this Friday the 13th franchise is the one that was supposed to win an Oscar. The movie that would later be called Jason vs. Carrie. Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. I look forward to watching it with all of you 2 weeks from now. Until then, pleasant dreams, my friends.